Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 183, Mindfulness, Harm Reduction, and Relapse Prevention, November 21st, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
We had done a study here with college student binge drinkers where we taught them TM, and they practiced it for one academic quarter. And compared to muscle relaxation or just periods of quiet reading, the meditation group had a significantly lower rates of drinking and the follow-up. And most of them wanted to continue meditating because they liked it.
So says today's guest, Dr. Alan Marlatt, who is professor of psychology at the University of Washington and director of the Addictive Behaviors Research Center at that institution. He's conducted pioneering research on the role of meditation in three areas: harm reduction, brief interventions, and relapse prevention. You can find out more about Dr. Marlatt in our show notes at Shrink Wrap Radio. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Alan Marlatt, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm so pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you because your name keeps popping up in my other interviews. A couple of recent instances were my interviews with both Elisha Goldstein and his wife Stephanie Goldstein on clinical applications relating to mindfulness, and then even more recently in an interview with Pat Denning on harm reduction. And what I've been hearing is that your research is providing the foundation for some very innovative clinical approaches.
Well, thank you. We're hoping that that would be the case.
Yeah. Now, you know, speaking of innovative clinical approaches, I see you got your PhD in clinical psychology, as did I. How did you come to be so involved in research?
Well, originally I was hoping and thinking that I wanted to be a therapist, and clinical psychology was very appealing.
Right.
Way of doing that, and I'm from Canada, and back in 1964 when I started graduate school, there were no PhD clinical psychology training programs in Canada. Now there are several very good ones, but so if we wanted to go on, we had to come to the U.S. to get our training, and I got accepted by Indiana University. And they have a good clinical program, but they also have a very strong research scientist practitioner sort of orientation. And by the time I was halfway through, I realized this is really what I want to do, clinical research.
Interesting.
Yeah, because it was working well there, and I began to think, you know, this is something that not only can you help people on an individual basis doing one-on-one therapy, but if you could come up with some clinical programs that would help even more people, so much the better.
You must have run into a good advisor or maybe your doctoral dissertation advisor who maybe brought you into the research world.
Kenneth Heller was my PhD advisor, and actually when I was in graduate school, I was thinking about doing research or my dissertation on something to do with alcohol.
Yes.
And actually, my advisor said, well, you don't really want to go into that area. It's kind of low prestige.
Low prestige, and a morass.
Yes, exactly. Not very much good work going on there, and he discouraged me, and so I didn't do my dissertation anything to do with alcohol or drugs. I ended up looking at vicarious reinforcement of problem disclosure, which was a good study, but it wasn't until I got on my internship at Napa State Hospital in 1968 that I got a chance to work with people with drinking problems. And that got me going in terms of thinking of how to help people, especially around relapse issues.
Yeah, and Napa State Hospital, boy, that's just quite close to where I am, actually. It's about 20 minutes away from here. I actually used to lead student groups over there from, I think it was an abnormal psychology class that I was teaching.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to talk to you about your research on alcohol and drugs and relapse, but let's get started with your research on meditation and mindfulness. How did you first become interested in this area?
Well, when I moved to Seattle at the University of Washington, where I am now, this was 1972, I had kind of a high blood pressure problem. So I went to see a physician here in Seattle who said, well, you know, it's not too high, but it could be getting up there, and asked me what kinds of things I did to relax. And because, you know, I was still under a lot of, they used to say, publish or perish anxiety.
Yes, at a major university, that's the name of the game.
That's right. So, you know, I said, well, I do, you know, what most people do, watch TV, go to movies, get together with friends, you know, have social hours, things like that. And he said, what about meditation? So I said, well, actually, I'm trained as a behavioral therapist, and we don't do that kind of thing.
Now, what year would this be?
1973.
Okay.
Yeah. So he said, well, you do research, though, right? And I said, yes. And he pulled out his desk drawer and gave me a reprint, and he said, look, here's a study on people doing transcendental meditation and how it affects their blood pressure. And he showed me this graph where clearly 90 days of TM led to significant decreases in diastolic blood pressure.
This must have been Herbert Benson or one of his students.
Well, I never had heard of Herbert Benson and the relaxation response then, but later I did, of course. But
yeah.
This physician was very tuned into that.
Yeah, he was.
He basically said, you know, wouldn't you rather do meditation than be on medication for this? And so I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a try. And so I signed up for transcendental meditation class here in Seattle. In those days, you could do the class initiation was cost $100.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think it's $2,500.
Oh my goodness!
I was told last, but
wow.
But you know, this is the Maharishi's program where you get a mantra, a word that you say to yourself as you meditate to 20-minute periods a day. So I started doing that, and of course I could measure my blood pressure with a blood pressure kit. And sure enough, I found that after about 2 months, my blood pressure had dropped about 10 points on the diastolic. And not only that, you know, it was really the most relaxing thing I'd ever experienced in terms of stress reduction. So I began to think, wow, you know, maybe there's other applications of this, especially in terms of working with people with addiction problems. Because we know that a lot of addiction is driven by stress and self-medication as ways to cope with stress. And, you know, this might be helpful for people with those kinds of problems. So that's what got me into it.
Yeah, and now more recently, I believe you've gotten involved with an approach known as mindfulness meditation. Can you tell us how that happened and give us a, you know, your own brief definition of what's meant by mindfulness?
Well, after doing TM for several years, I sort of felt a little frustrated in terms of the literature and the theories and related to behavior change that was in the TM literature. Although I must say they were doing a lot of research for people with addiction problems, finding good results. And we had done a study here with college student binge drinkers, where we taught them TM, and they practiced it for one academic quarter. And compared to muscle relaxation or just periods of quiet reading, the meditation group had a significantly lower rates of drinking and the follow-up. And most of them wanted to continue meditating because they liked it. And there was a book that came out talking about positive addictions at the time, and there was descriptions of meditation and exercise for people with addiction problems could be very helpful. So I thought, well, I've got to. What happened actually was I went to a retreat that TM people put on down in California. I think this was in 1981.
Okay.
And I was there, and everybody was all excited because they said the Maharishi had said that there was a comet coming through the skies the same weekend that we were on the retreat.
Yes.
Kohoutek's comet.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Sure.
And everybody was thinking it would be even more brilliant than Halley's comet, even though it really didn't turn out to be. But people were saying, the Maharishi has said that anybody touched by the tail of Kohoutek's comet will be instantly enlightened. So at that point, I packed up my bags and left. I thought, this is too... I can't, you know, this is not what I call empirical approaches here. So I got back and I, one of my graduate students said, well, what about Buddhist meditation or mindfulness? I said, you know, I don't know anything about that. So she handed me a book by Choegram Trungpa, who was the director of the Naropa Institute,
yes.
Tibetan meditator.
Yes.
This was one of his many books. This one was called Meditation in Action. And I read this book. I was on an airplane traveling to a conference, and I read it, and I thought, my gosh, this guy really knows what's happening in my mind. It was kind of like the book is written just for you.
Wow. Somehow.
And that's what turned the corner for me. And since then, I've really become more involved in working with Buddhist teachers who teach mindfulness.
Yes.
And mindfulness mainly is sort of described as a state of metacognition, a state of awareness. You're aware of what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what's happening in terms of your emotions, but in a non-judgmental position of observing. It's like you're sitting on the banks of a river, watching the river go down, and there's all these different leaves and things in the river that are your different thoughts and different feelings, and you're trained to just observe them and let them go, instead of what we usually do, especially our egos. You know, we hook on to different thoughts and sort of become obsessed with them and go on to ruminate about them. And that can lead us into, especially when you're feeling an episode of stress, can make it even more stressful. So what they call in Buddhism, they call stress and suffering, they call it dukkha. And if you start thinking about it, oh, how did I get into this? I'm so bad, you know, I can't get out of it. They call that double dukkha. Huh. So you're adding on all this additional difficulties in terms of being able to accept what's going on. So that's really, then I did a number of meditation retreats. Since then, these 10-day retreats, there's... ones that I'm mostly familiar with are called Vipassana.
Yes.
You know, which means seeing things the way they really are. Like I did a number of retreats with S.N. Goenka, who's an amazingly powerful teacher of Vipassana from India in the Buddhist tradition. And if you have been to one of those, you realize this is 10 days of silence.
Right.
Meditating, sitting meditation and walking meditation. And the only... time that people, there's any talking going on is in the evening when the teacher gives a, what they call a Dharma talk about the Buddhist philosophy. And you can talk to your teacher if you're having problems, but you don't talk to anyone else who's at the retreat with you. So it's an amazing experience. Not only do you not do talking, but there's no email, there's no telephone contact.
What? No email.
Yeah, no email. Going to email withdrawal. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and after a couple of days, you realize, oh my God, it's good not to have to do email every day.
Uh-huh. I take it this must have been a positive experience for you because you've done it more than once.
I've done it several times. Most recently, I've been working with two teachers who are both former students of Choegram Trungpa. One is Pema Chodron.
Yes,
and
I know
who's written many books, but the one that really caught my attention in the beginning was When Things Fall Apart, it's called. And I went to a retreat, a 10-day retreat that she taught at the Rocky Mountain Shambhala Center in Colorado.
Yes.
On that theme, and it was so powerful. I decided at the end of it I wanted to take the first step in terms of becoming a Buddhist student, which is called Taking Refuge. And taking refuge means simply that you're going to take refuge in the Buddha, the refuge in the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, and refuge in the Sangha, which is the support group that you meditate with. And they give you a Buddhist name at that point and hope that you will continue in your Buddhist studies.
Now, has
so
this,
I did that with her.
Yeah. Excellent. Has this in... I'm just coming out of an academic environment, one far less traditional, I suspect, than the one that you're in. I'm just wondering if this involvement has in any way affected your standing or the way that you're perceived there in the, quote,
academy.
Well,
I think in the beginning there was some, you know, because we were in a pretty traditional behavioral psychology program. Mm-hmm. That people were saying, no, that's a bit woo-woo. Isn't that what you're doing there in terms of meditation? But then it turns out a couple of the other faculty here also got very interested in meditation. And one of them is Marcia Linehan.
Oh, yes. I've interviewed her, as a matter of fact.
Yes. Her dialectical behavioral therapy.
Right.
Includes what she calls it wise mind. But it's mindfulness techniques for people who have borderline personality disorder or... or at risk for suicide, and she's a student of Zen meditation, and even though she's trained in the traditional cognitive behavioral, she's really integrated mindfulness in a big way.
I just find it so fascinating, the various people who have brought this into kind of married it to mainstream techniques of either behavioral techniques and in some cases psychodynamic techniques.
Yes, in fact, in terms of psychodynamic techniques, another colleague here, Robert Kohlenberg, has integrated mindfulness as a way of looking what happens in the therapeutic alliance.
Oh, I don't know him.
Yeah, he's got a program called, he calls it FAP, Functional Analytic Psychotherapy. And he's got just one book out on that with that title. He's coming out with a second edition. And he also is very interested in his case, he's talking about the mindfulness of the therapist. When dealing with clients and how that can enhance the therapeutic alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And he's working with a number of clients, and he's also working with people who are depressed who are also heavy smokers, using mindfulness as a way to help them deal with problems and quit smoking.
Wow.
Now, what we did was we had a program called Relapse Prevention. We published a book in 1985 with that title. And what that book does is try to talk about triggers for relapse. If you've been in a program, so it's kind of during the aftercare stage, to help people understand what might throw them off the wagon in terms of their commitment to an abstinence-based program, for alcohol or other drugs or smoking or whatever people are doing, trying to quit. And it's a cognitive behavioral approach. We teach cognitive coping skills, looking at your expectations about drug use, looking at self-efficacy, how confident you are you could get through difficult situations without relapsing, attributions for relapse, and teaching people behavioral coping skills, how to say no if somebody's a friend is trying to get you to use. But most relapse, the biggest trigger we found are what we call negative emotional states. So anxiety, stress, depression, anger, that for most people is the biggest category of triggers. So we did mention in the relapse prevention book that meditation could be helpful because of the work that Jon Kabat-Zinn had been doing on what he calls mindfulness-based stress reduction at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. And so I actually met with John and talked to him about his program. And later, Zindel Siegel at the University of Toronto also developed a mindfulness program for depression called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy. So what we've got now is a program called Mindfulness-Based Relapse Prevention. And we are going to be publishing a book next year describing the program and kind of a therapist manual. We have a grant from National Institute on Drug Abuse to evaluate the program in a randomized controlled trial here in Seattle. We've got preliminary four-month outcome data already available, and it's definitely looking good. Significantly less relapse, less negative emotional states for people that did the mindfulness course compared to the treatment-as-usual control group.
Excellent.
And this program is a group-based program, so just like Kabat-Zinn's program that meets weekly for 8 weeks, 2 hours in duration, and that's the same for Zindel Siegel's program, and it's the same for our program. So it's basically asking people to combine, it's a two-hour meeting, so 1 hour we do meditation practice, different kinds of practice, including things like body scans, paying attention to your physical sensations, especially associated with craving for alcohol or other drugs. We do a thing called urge surfing. If you're having a strong urge to smoke a cigarette, for example, after you've been trying to quit, instead of giving into it, just imagine it's like a wave that's going to rise up, and you pay attention to your breath as a kind of a surfboard to keep your balance while the urge passes and goes down the other side. Because most urges are like conditioned responses, you know, Pavlov's dog, you ring the bell, start salivating. And yet if you don't give in at that point, you can ride it through. So we teach them that kind of technique. We teach them mini meditations. One's called sober. So if you're having a strong urge and you feel like you're on the brink of giving in and using, sober just says, first, S stands for stop what you're doing. Just take a break here. O, observe how you're feeling. B, focus on your breath as your surfboard, whatever you want to call it, your centering technique. And then E, expand your awareness. So feel feelings without your body, and also what happens if you did give in to the temptation, what would happen later, sort of thinking through the drink is what they call it sometimes. And then finally, R, respond mindfully. So these little mini meditations, people have been telling us who just went through the program, were very helpful. Little tools that they could use when they're on the spot.
That sounds great.
Yeah, so far so good. Now, we put in a bigger application to NIDA to do a larger study. That grant just went in last week, so we won't know for a few months whether we're funded or whether there's any funding for health research left.
we hope.
National Institutes of Health, yeah, I know. But anyway, that's where we're at with it, and it feels like a good combination, the mindfulness and cognitive behavioral skills seem to go together.
Yes,
complement each other.
You know, I've thought so actually before I started talking to people like you. I was telling my students that it seemed to me that the East and West were coming together, that they were coming to the same conclusion, that the action was, a lot of the action was kind of in the mind and self-talk.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and so it's so wonderful to discover that kind of sense that I had was, in fact, on track somehow. Now, you're also involved with something called the harm reduction movement.
Yes.
Yeah, tell us a bit about that. What's meant by harm reduction?
Well, harm reduction really originated in the Netherlands when they realized that injecting drug users were at risk for HIV if they shared their needles.
Yeah.
And so it was actually the users themselves that formed what they called a junkie bond, a sort of union of users who went to the government saying, people are coming down with HIV because of needles being shared. We need needles to be more available so that people don't have to share them, lower the price, make them more accessible. And that was the birth of needle exchange programs. And I was on sabbatical in Amsterdam in the early 80s, and I was working in the drug treatment center there, the Jelinek Center, they call it, and teaching them about relapse prevention. And they said, well, we're going to teach you about harm reduction. And so they told me, you know, that if you go to the red light district in Amsterdam, there's a lot of sex workers that are all licensed by the government. They have to go through regular health checks. Condoms are required, their services, if there's any problems that they're having with clients, the police are available and they can get help right away. I noticed, by the way, on the election today, there's a plebiscite or something in California to try and decriminalize prostitution for similar reasons.
Yes.
Sort of do a harm reduction approach. They're saying, look, people are going to do these things anyway. They're going to also want to experiment with illegal drugs. So we're going to set up these coffee shops where people can legally, or not exactly legally, but can consume marijuana. And that's going to be monitored. The sales will be taxed. The money goes back into drug education in the schools. And they basically started this over 25 years ago. And they found, I was just looking at some recent statistics, that adolescent marijuana use in the Netherlands is quite a bit lower than it is in the U.S., where it's, you know, completely illegal. So
some of the thrill is gone, you know. When it's, I went to Amsterdam, yeah. And, you know, some of the thrill is gone in a way.
Right. When you can just do this, you know, so yeah. Adolescent, you don't get that additional sense of violating the tradition. So that's what they've basically feel. So then I started to look at harm reduction in terms of drinking. So most of the work we've done over the last 10 years has actually been with heavy drinking adolescents and especially college students.
Yes.
College students are a particularly high-risk population because of their freshmen coming in, they're away from home usually for the first time, they're with other people that are drinking a lot.
Yeah, I was on your site, and I saw you quote a statistic: 44% of college students report binge drinking at least once in a 2-week period.
Yeah, and actually 20% are frequent binge drinkers; they're doing this several times a month. And the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, if you go to their website, there's a report called "Call to Action" about college drinking. And they reported that anywhere from 1,200 to 1,400 college students die every year from alcohol-related causes. Of course, there are car crashes, but there are also, like, the last death we had here at the University of Washington was in the residence halls where a student, a woman, turned 21. So she wanted to have her 21st birthday party, which, of course, means getting loaded. Legal drinking age, but a lot of her friends that she had with her at the party were not yet 21, so they didn't want to get caught by the residence hall advisor that kind of checks it around about drinking or underage drinking.
Right.
So one student said, well, there's a balcony up on the 7th floor that they never go there. Why don't we just take our stuff up there and have our party there? There was, I think, about 8 of them. So up they went, and then they thought, we better drink fast because we don't want the bottles around as evidence. And the young man who died tragically was, he was drinking a lot, and he was telling a funny story and sitting on the balcony. There was a little railing there, and he just lost his balance.
Wow.
And went over and head first on the concrete below and was killed on impact.
Wow.
And his blood alcohol level was 0.26. You know, and here in Washington State, the legal level for intoxication is 0.08.
Oh, my
so he
goodness.
Was over 3 times that.
Yes.
And there have been other students, just in terms of turning 21, they have this game where you have to drink 21 shots of whiskey in 1 hour.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds fatal.
And this has been fatal for a number of students. They overdose. They don't. Many college students don't realize you can overdose and kill yourself from drinking because it can paralyze the respiratory system. You know, they know that maybe about heroin, but they don't realize that can be true about alcohol.
Yes.
So we have a we actually had 2 programs that we developed through funding from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. One's for groups of students. We call it the Alcohol Skills Training Program. And that program is similar in a way to what students do when they take a driver's course, learning safe driving techniques to get their license. And what we're saying is drinking and driving are both dangerous, especially if you do them together, of course, but either way. But people that are learning how to drive, they get a lot of information about the regulations, about speed limits, about how to deal with difficult situations on the road. But we don't do that in most cases for drinking. So our program, that's what we do. We teach them about blood alcohol levels. We teach them about their individual risk factors. If they have a family history of alcohol problems, how that increases their risk, what the cognitive effects are in terms of blackouts, in terms of not being able to anticipate consequences, what we call the alcohol myopia effect that puts people into situations where they do things that, you know, get them into big trouble just because they couldn't think through what was going to happen. dealing with immediate gratification. And also, most students don't realize that alcohol is what we call a biphasic drug. In other words, when you first drink, first few drinks, yeah, you feel good. You feel high, or depends on what do you call it, a little euphoria. But if you keep drinking, the depressant effects kick in. So you start going down instead of further up on the emotional reaction side. And that's when you start losing your coordination. You are going to have more problems in terms of memory, in terms of possibly getting into fights, passing out, blackouts, all this stuff.
Yeah, I remember being a young person myself, and at some point I learned, first of all, I couldn't tolerate alcohol very well and would get horribly hungover. So there was no way that I was
going to protective factor.
Yeah, I was never going to become an alcoholic. But somewhere along, you know, and I did have my share of binge drinking on at least a few occasions. But somewhere along the line, I learned that there was a point where, you know, where I would have that enjoyable sense of intoxication, and after which it was only going to go downhill.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And so as a, quote, yep, mature drinker, I mean, I just know, you know, when to stop. And
yeah.
Which
well,
for me is probably two drinks.
Yes. We call it the point of diminishing returns, where
yeah,
one more drink is not going to make you feel any happier, or, you know, it's sort of going to take you the other way.
Right, exactly.
And how long it takes for the body to come off alcohol, a lot of students don't realize it's, for every point, like if you're 0.08, it's going to take you 8 hours, 1 hour for each point to come back down to zero. So many of them don't realize if they party all night and in the morning, you know, they're still, their blood alcohol levels are still fairly high. So there's, we teach them all about that, and we've gotten very promising results in terms of the alcohol skills training program. And then the most recent program, it's a one-on-one program, not a group-based program. It's called BASICS. And it stands for Brief Alcohol Screening and Intervention for College Students. And we have the manual. Guilford Press publishes all of our manuals, by the way. But anyway, BASICS uses motivational interviewing, which is, of course, Bill Miller's approach. So rather than confronting the student about his or her drinking problems, most of the students that we see, by the way, on campus are referred to us by the housing authorities or by campus police, or sometimes we get volunteers, but that's mostly how they come in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're expecting that, you know, there's going to be a lot of confrontation and sort of coming down on them. But motivational interviewing, no. We're trying to, like, meet people where they're at, talk about what's going on, what they like about drinking, what could be some of the problems, and give them feedback about their risks after we give them a number of questionnaires about that, and whether they're diagnosable as alcohol abuse or alcohol dependence or just high-risk drinking, which is mostly what we see. Most of these college students actually mature out of this heavy drinking as they get into their 20s. So it's just a very high-risk period. Now, of course, some of them will continue, and we'll have more serious alcohol problems, so we're trying to reach both groups. And anyway, so the first session, we give them feedback about their drinking. We're being very accepting of the person and sort of working with them rather than coming down on them. And then in the second session, we come up with a new action plan. You know, the stages of change model, of course, that a lot of these students are in pre-contemplation about their drinking. They're not thinking that there's any problem. But then they get into some trouble, so they're in the contemplation stage. Maybe I should do something. What are the pros and the cons? So we try and look at those with the student. And then finally, the action stage. Here's my new drinking plan. And we collaborate with them. It's a different plan for each person depending on their risk factors and their gender and so forth. Anyway, BASICS, we've done lots of studies with it. We've done four-year follow-ups comparing BASICS to treatment as usual or whatever else they would get. And we're getting significant reductions, not only in drinking rates, but from a harm reduction perspective, significant reductions in harmful consequences. We use things like the Rutgers Alcohol Problem Inventory. That looks at things that we were talking about, like passing out or getting into fights or blackouts or driving under the influence.
Okay.
So the program has now been designated a model program by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And we're probably, it's being used in up to, I think, about 2,000 colleges now. So.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So it has been taken up by others. That's great.
Yep, we get calls every week, especially, you know, when school starts.
And
it's like the beginning when the freshmen are at the highest risk because it's a whole new environment for most of them. And depends on whether the college is, like here at the University of Washington, most of the students commute in. They don't live here on campus, although, you know, some of them do.
It's a beautiful campus. I've been there. It's a beautiful campus.
But if you go to Washington State University, everybody lives on campus because, you know, it's a little tiny town. And the drinking rates are much higher in those kinds of places. So it's a lot of it is dealing with interpersonal influence and what your, you know, other friends of yours are doing. And so we look at all that. As potential risk factors.
Yes. Now, we often hear that alcoholism is a disease, but you say that alcoholism is not a disease. Can you say a bit about that?
Well, I sort of same with smoking and things like that. You know, some people would say, yeah, smoking is a disease. Well, smoking, from my perspective, is a habit highly reinforced through nicotine, which has huge disease consequences. In fact, smoking is the biggest killer in terms of any of the addictive behaviors, in terms of lung cancer and heart failures and things like that. And yet, most people don't see smoking itself as a disease. Now, this whole controversy about addiction, you know, is all addiction a disease? What we find is all drugs affect the brain, and the brain reward centers are extremely important, dopamine release and things like this. But what's driving that is the behavior. And the behavior gets started through reinforcing consequences. You know, people drink and start to get the reward effects, and that increases the habit. And you can develop dependence, of course, or what they call abuse, continued potentially harmful drinking, not necessarily with physiological dependence, or alcohol dependence, where you are, you know, physically hooked. Well, at that point, there are still disease consequences, but I don't think it's helpful to say that the drinking itself is a disease. It's the behavior and the habit that sort of increases the risk of these consequences. Now, right now, there's a much more emphasis, even within the National Institute of Drug Abuse, they call drug addiction a disease of the brain or brain disease. Well, you know, I understand what they're saying, but I don't know if that's the best way to look at it in terms of behavioral change. Because what they're saying is that the best treatment are pharmacotherapies, things that affect the brain, like naltrexone or Compressate or various drugs to reduce craving. Or with smoking cessation, it would be nicotine replacement. Now, they can be helpful. But the best research shows that you need a combination of some cognitive behavioral approach plus pharmacotherapy to get the best effects. So it's a big debate. You know, I think that most behavioral people are on the, let's look at the disease consequences, but let's look at the habit that's running this thing and how we can do habit change to reduce the negative consequences.
Okay. Hey, coming back to the mindfulness meditation we started with, it seems to me that the process of mindfulness meditation is very much like practicing for relapse prevention. In meditation, you're trying to sustain your concentration. At some point, you fail. But instead of getting upset, you accept that the mind is prone to wander, and you gently bring it back. So it seems to me that every time you do that, in a way, you're practicing being more gentle with yourself about your lapses while still keeping your overall focus on the goal.
Very true. Yeah. We have a concept that seems to distinguish between people who have a lapse and then kind of completely fall off the wagon and have a total relapse compared to other people that have a lapse but seem to get back on the wagon again. They learn from their mistake or whatever. And the big difference is what we call the abstinence violation effect. And that means that people who have that are likely to say, oh, my God, I had a cigarette or I had a drink, and that means I can't do this, I have no willpower, I failed. And they get really down on themselves.
Yes.
And that makes them more stressed out, so they're even more likely to look for self-medication, you know. And it goes into a vicious cycle.
Right.
So being able to look at a lapse, you know, hey, lapses occur, and that's the way it goes. You're trying to learn new ways of coping, and sometimes you have a setback. But take a look at what happened, what could you do differently the next time, accept the fact that you can still make good progress and get back on track. So you're right, that's very true in terms of people's reactions to slips.
Okay, well, I'm going to make sure that I put some links in the show notes to your website, and particularly to the presentation site that you showed me, where a lot of PowerPoint presentations are available for download that review the research that you've been discussing here. And as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, I just was mentioning earlier that there were two meditation teachers, Pema Chodron, that was very helpful. But the one that I've been working with most recently is, his name is Reginald Ray, R-A-Y.
Okay.
And he's trying to integrate things like yoga and working with the body with mindfulness meditation. And his new book, I would highly recommend, it's called Touching Enlightenment. And it's all about what he's trying to integrate. And working with the body, especially with cravings and urges and drug effects, is very... very powerful for, especially working with people with addiction problems. So he's somebody I would recommend if people are interested in where else to go. He has several other books, but that's the most recent one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you've been very generous with your time here and information. So Dr. Alan Marlett, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David. I enjoyed our conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Alan Marlatt and learned as much as I did. And speaking of learning, you can learn quite a bit more if you're so motivated by going to his website at the University of Washington, where Dr. Marlatt has posted a number of his presentations. The URL is https://depts.washington.edu. That's edu/abrc/presentations.htm. Now, that URL is a bit long. I'll put it in the show notes as well in case you're not in a place where you can write it down. At any rate, on that page, you'll find presentations on Vipassana meditation, presentation slides, a college drinking presentation slides, harm reduction presentation slides, relapse prevention presentation slides, journeys of the circle presentation slides, as well as some films, cognitive behavioral relapse prevention for addictions, reducing alcohol problems on campus, harm reduction, defining it and doing it properly to reduce harm, regulating excess from harm reduction to relapse prevention. You'll also find some related interviews on my Wise Counsel podcast series, notably the interview with Dr. Pat Denning on harm reduction, and one that I'll be posting soon with Annie Fahey on motivational interviewing, which Dr. Alan Marlatt referred to several times. That should keep you busy for a while. Remember, all of this will be on the final.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Hey, I've just posted a video promo for Shrink Wrap Radio on the website. You can check it out under the Promos tab at the top of the page. There's also a link to the embed code for it on YouTube, and I'm hoping you'll help me promote the show by embedding the short video on your MySpace or Facebook or blog page. There's so many more people out there who could be benefiting from the edutainment this show provides, if only they knew about it. You'll also notice under that promo tab that there's a Shrink Wrap Radio flyer that you can print out and post in any relevant public areas you might be aware of. Thanks for your help in spreading the word. If you're listening to the show but haven't subscribed, please do so. Most people subscribe through iTunes. It costs you nothing, and there's a handy link to the iTunes subscription page on our site. At the same time, I'm appealing for financial donations to help support what's turned out to be a rather massive solo effort. There is a donations page on the site where you can make a single donation or ongoing support of either $5 or $10 a month. With my impeccable sense of timing, it seems I've made this decision to go to a donations model just as the world is headed into a financial crisis and everyone is holding tight to their wallets. However, you can help fight this crisis by putting a little bit of your hard-earned money into circulation through your donation. Believe it or not, if you go ahead and make a donation, you'll actually feel richer.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Robin Maiden calling. I just want to say I thoroughly enjoyed The Art of Engagement. That podcast is fantastic as I'm trying to bring new media into the organization that I'm a part of. I keep running into a lot of the things that you guys talked about on the podcast. So, excellent podcast. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Always enjoy Shrink Wrap Radio, and always a pleasure to listen to you. Take care. This is Robin signing off with Tailwinds.
Hey, Robin. Thanks so much for that feedback. Robin Maiden and his wife Suzanne are, of course, the personalities behind Insight Works, one of my favorite podcasts and two of my favorite podcasters. Plus, Robin works in the background on the Dear Zanny and DivaCast podcasts, as well as a corporate podcast he produces for Delta Airlines, where he's also a pilot. By the way, I want to acknowledge listener Jamie Johnson, who's made a PayPal donation on our Top Spots widget, advertising her private practice of EFT, that's Emotional Freedom Technique, and hypnosis in the Salt Lake City area. She's also available for phone consultations. Adding yourself to our Top Spots widget is yet another way that you can support Shrink Wrap Radio. Now let's catch up on some of those back emails from our listener community. Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, whom you may recall, she wrote to say that she's no fan of affiliate advertising that we've carried in the past. She goes on to say, they don't appeal to me at all. Donations are interesting, but I think maybe it needs a poem and or a song or something. And then she gives this example. If you like this show and you want to hear more, your cash donation will open the door. There's so much to learn and so much to know. Your small donation can help us all grow. Hey, thanks for that suggestion, Sarah. Hey, you know those wonderful little ditties, though, that I've been playing? My Shrink Wrap Radio tunes by Jeff Smith, those don't come for free. I've actually invested a fair amount of money getting him to record those, and he hasn't gotten any cheaper as he's gotten a lot more popular. So I'll need a lot more donations before I'm going to set another one of those to music, unless I try to sing it myself. And believe me, it won't be of the quality that you have become accustomed to. Next, we hear from listener Cosmin, who writes, Hello, Dave. I've been listening to your interesting shows for a while, and I think they are very valuable. I came across one very appealing to me, number 104, Psychology and Cyber Sexuality, but unfortunately the sound quality wasn't very good, and I was wondering if there's any available transcript for that show. Thank you. Well, you're in luck. It just so happens that number 104 got transcribed this very day and is available on the web at shrinkwrapradio.com. Cosmin, I hope you're listening. The next email reads, Dear Dr. Dave, kudos for great work and inspiration you are producing and broadcasting. I'm a fervent listener to Coast AM, Art Bell, and Georges Nouri, and subscribe to their streaming. It's a perfect way to support the non-commercial downloads and programs. So in that line of thought, I have just subscribed for $5 a month for a year to your programs. Yay! Hopefully they will become longer and more in-depth. They are too short right now for my taste. I barely get excited and the interview is finished. Keep up the good work and give us more. You will receive more. You get my vote. My friend Michael Cox of San Diego turned me on to your program with number 178 and now number 180. being a tarot reader with Voyager Tarot and having done seminars with James Wanless, it was very interesting to listen to such an interview. With love and joy, Gabriel the Seagull. Thanks so much for that feedback, Gabriel, and thank you especially for your donation, which runs for a year, and that's the kind of support that we really can use here. Next, we hear from Herbert, who writes from Germany. Dear Dr. Dave, thank you very much for all the interesting and wonderful interviews. I like the way you ask questions, things concerning their CV, experience, daily business, and personal insights of your interviewees. Keep on. It would be a pleasure for me if you could answer a question via mail, and I know that it's a very hard question because of so little information. Now, I'm reading this letter out loud in hopes that maybe one of you listeners has an answer here, because I'm not sure which podcast he's referring to. But he goes on to say, in one interview, an interviewee mentioned a website for people with problems of imagination. He uttered this website had tips and tricks for better visualization. Please excuse me that I could not remember the content of the interview. It was the time where I discovered your website and listened to 3 to 4 interviews a day, so I have the problem that I got mixed up with the context. Now, the topic of visualization and imagination gets into my focus, and I'm very interested in it. Perhaps if you can remember the interview or the website, would you do me the favor and send me a note? Keep on interviewing. Yours, Herbert from Germany. So if you recognize what he's referring to, a time when I gave out, when I interviewed a guest relating to issues of imagination and visualization and referred people to a website that had some coaching on that, I thought it might be the James Wanless Tarot interview, and there was one other that came to mind, and I sent both of those suggestions to Herbert, and I haven't heard back from him. Well, I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemail for me, as Robin did, which was wonderful, at 206-337-0622. You can send me MP3 files with your audio. Thanks again to Dr. Marlatt for sharing his groundbreaking work. Next week's guest will be one of my longtime Sonoma State University colleagues, Dana Schneider, talking about her innovative therapy work with court-mandated families. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.